Before the talk this evening, I asked if anybody had any suggested topics, and everyone gave me very boring answers. So what I might do is, apart from encouraging you to think of some more exciting Dhamma talk topics next time, is to give a talk that in some way would be a pair of or a complement to the talk I gave last week. And last week I spoke about faith and the role that faith has in Buddhism, which of course is, as always in Buddha's teachings, faith is a nuanced and subtle thing. And of course faith in the Buddha's sense is an emotional quality, which is an uplifting and positive response to the experience of suffering, and a response which has within it a sense of hope, a sense of possibility that there can be a way out of that suffering. And so in that sense faith has a very powerful positive quality, but of course at the same time the faith has to be tempered with reason and tempered with experience. And if we are not able to do that, then the faith itself, which intrinsically is quite a positive thing, becomes a very destructive and potentially dangerous force. And we see that particularly when faith becomes used and becomes anti-reason, and you find a war between, say, religion and science, as is very characteristic in some modern circles, most obviously in the American politics and so on, where you see this almost complete takeover of the right wing of politics by these bizarrely irrational views. You know, there's hardly anybody who's in the presidential candidates for the Republican Party. There's hardly anyone who actually, for example, believes in climate change, or anybody who's prepared to sort of stand up and clearly say that creationism is not science and shouldn't be taught in schools. So the kind of this irrational mindset has conquered because of the divorce of faith from reason, from intelligence, from evidence. And so this is something which is very dangerous, and obviously America is not the only place this has happened. It can be discerned in all forms of what we call fundamentalism, and perhaps indeed that's what at its root fundamentalism is the divorce of faith from reason and the elevation of faith above all else. So, as well as this nuanced understanding of faith, the Buddha also spoke of the complement to that, the other side of that, the wisdom, the intelligence, the reason. He also spoke of this in a nuanced sense. And what I'd like to focus on for this evening's talk is to talk about views, what the Buddha called dhyāti. And dhyāti, of course, being a question of considerable importance, because samādhi, or right view, is the first factor of the Noble Path. So if we don't sort out what a view is, what's right view, what's wrong view, how do we develop it and so on, then the rest of the path won't unfold for us. So I want to start out by just considering for a moment this thing called a view and what it is. Now, the Pali word that we use for a view is the word ditti. And ditti, as in the first factor of the Eightfold Path, is sometimes mistranslated as being right understanding. But right understanding is precisely what it is not. Sama ditti is right theory, right view. The right understanding would be the samanyana, which we usually translate as right wisdom, right knowledge. So sama ditti as such is a theory. It's having the right idea about things. And wrong, micha ditti, or wrong view, is having the wrong idea about things, the wrong theory. Now, of course, when we phrase it in simplistic terms like that, then it makes it seem like it very easy. There are certain things that are right view and there are certain things that are wrong view, and we just have to let go of the wrong view and develop the right view. And obviously we find in the Buddhist scriptures that there are plenty of times where this kind of approach is taken. And I think that experientially, that that's also obviously the case, that there are certain things that we believe or that we think are true, which are simply mistaken. And if we're not able to abandon that view and develop right view, then we can't really progress on the path. So I'll just give an example. There, of course, there are many examples of that which are not relevant for spiritual practice. But say an example which is relevant for spiritual practice, just to take, say, a typical example, one might be, say, that meditation is useless, or that meditation is inherently harmful. And this is a view which many people have. The idea that meditation is useless, you know, probably held by many people who don't really know what meditation is and don't know that it has a genuine experiential basis, but think of it as being just some kind of bizarre form of mysticism. And the idea that meditation is harmful is a very common idea among fundamentalist Christian circles, who will teach this as quite a regular piece of doctrine. And I think it hardly needs to be said that as long as you hold these views, then you're not going to meditate and you're not going to experience the benefits of meditation. You're not going to progress in that path. So in that case, that's clearly a wrong view. It needs to be abandoned. You need to realize actually that meditation can be very helpful. And then that opens the possibility to actually practice meditation. Of course, it doesn't make you go and meditate. Right? Somebody might have the wrong view that meditation is useless, and then I can maybe show them some studies, experiments and so on, which show that meditation brings stress reduction, makes people happier, brings various health benefits and so on, and then maybe can convince them in that means to abandon that wrong view and develop a right view. And when they have that right view, they may or may not actually meditate, but at least it's possible that they might meditate. So that's a simple example of a relatively straightforward case of a wrong view and a right view, and to show how wrong views are quite clearly obstructive to the path of practice. Right? This is not purely just a theoretical question. There are many views that we hold which decisively shape what we do, how we do, how we go about things. And if those views are wrong in important ways, then that will be genuinely obstructive to the path. So that's a clear-cut case. But what about a more of a grey area? Okay, so there are other things which are more ambiguous. So, for example, if I try to think of a wrong view which is perhaps more ambiguous, what about, say, the wrong view that jhana is not necessary for awakening? Right? Again, very common view in Buddhist circles, a view which many people, senior monks and teachers and so on have stated unequivocally to be the case, but a view which, in my opinion anyway, is a wrong view. Now, is that the kind of wrong view which is going to be so obstructive on the path? Well, my answer to that would be, it kind of depends. It might be in the sense that if you really believe that jhanas are not essential, then when you're doing your meditation practice, you might approach your meditation in a way that would preclude you from actually ever getting jhanas. So, for example, you might only ever sit meditation for short periods of time, not long enough to develop deep concentration. Or you might use a meditation method which doesn't allow you to develop deep concentration. Or you might say, well, since that deep concentration is not necessary, then merely practicing mindfulness in daily life is enough and I don't have to meditate at all. And so on. So there are practical implications which might affect whether that actually works or not. There are other possibilities, of course. The other possibility is that even though one might have this idea that jhana is not necessary, but nevertheless, while you're practicing, maybe you have various kinds of experiences. Maybe jhanas, maybe not even jhanas, but maybe even some other experiences which cause you to question that view. Maybe it's still possible to have the view that jhanas are not necessary and still get into jhanas. It happens. Even the teachers on the Vipassana retreats say that it happens. Because people are meditating intensively all day, and so sometimes the mind slips into deep concentration, even if you're not striving to do that or intent on doing that. So in that case, I don't think that view is necessarily completely obstructive. That view might be helpful, it might not be. It might be obstructive in one case, it might not be obstructive in another case. It might be useful at certain stages of development. For example, somebody who's new to meditation might find solace in the fact that, oh, well, I don't have to develop deep concentration, but if I'm just, I can't do that, but if I can at least be mindful, then that's good enough. And they might find that that's actually supportive and actually helps them to practice. And later on the path, they can maybe still progress. So this is, I think, an example of a view. So my point here is not to argue whether this is in fact right view or wrong view. My point is simply to show that this is a nuanced situation, that in certain kinds of wrong views might be completely obstructive to spiritual practice. Other kinds of wrong views might play out differently in different cases and might in some cases be helpful or obstructive, depending on the conditions. So these are views which are specifically related to practice, but then there are other views which are more general, which the Buddha also discussed. For example, views about whether the world is finite or infinite and so on, views about the first beginning of things, and these kinds of more speculative or cosmological ideas. So these are things which in and of themselves are not right or wrong. They're not things that have an ethical consequence in particular. For example, you can believe that the universe is infinite and live a perfectly good life. You can also believe the universe is finite and also live a perfectly good life. And your view on that particular point is not going to really affect the way that you live very much. But still, in some ways, the Buddha still criticized this kind of view and said that we should be careful of it. So what is actually going on here, and why the concern for these, if these things are not in themselves preventing us from practicing? Why are they important spiritually? Why isn't it just who cares if you believe the world's finite or infinite? So this is something which also deserves a little bit of consideration. So let's step back a little bit and look at what a view is and how it manifests in our minds. Now, The first thing, I think, is to recognize that a view is not a thing. A view is not a static entity, and it doesn't concretely exist, even to the degree that, for example, thoughts or memories might concretely exist. Okay, so you can have a thought, I believe that jhanas are necessary for awakening. I can have that thought, but that's just a thought. That's not a view. Somebody might hold the opposite view, but they can still think that thought. Somebody might not even know what jhanas are, but they can still say to themselves, jhanas are necessary for awakening. So the view is different from the thought. And thoughts are something which, in a sense, concretely and specifically exist. They occur at a certain time. Yeah, we can say, a minute ago, I had the thought that. But we can't say, a minute ago, I had the view that. A view is something that's much more abstract, much more long-term, and so harder to pin down. So if I was to ask what actually a view is, I would think maybe that a view is something which is a pattern of thought, idea, memory, perception, and so on. It's a pattern which arises conditioned by both internal and external factors. And I'll come back to that in a moment. It arises conditioned by both internal and external factors, and which persists over a period of time, relatively unchanged, not absolutely unchanged, but relatively unchanged. When I say it persists, I don't mean that there's a thing that lasts over that period. What I mean is that patterns of thought, behavior, and so on, which are recognizably similar, tend to occur over that period of time. Okay, so when we say, again, if we talk about a view, then this is again something which I think we've all experienced, that, you know, if you know somebody for a long period of time, someone in your family or something, and you might bring up a topic that people have views about, religion or politics or something, and you can discuss that, and you find that people tend to have the same kinds of views over a long period of time. They'll tend to say the same kinds of things. Okay, so the exact thing that a person says this year is different from what they said last year, but they'll tend to say the same kinds of things. So this is what I mean to say when this is what I mean when I'm saying that a view is a pattern which has a certain persistence over time. Remembering, it's just an abstract thing. It's not actually something that exists as such. So views always exist, and I'll come back to what I said before, views always exist and arise from both inner and outer factors. Okay? Now those inner and outer factors that views arise from are things which necessarily are more primitive than the views themselves. So, for example, I always find that it's useful when thinking about these things to reflect, for example, on, say, infant development and development of a child. When a child is born, they don't have any views like this, in the sense of articulated positions. You know, they're not, people sometimes say, I'm born Buddhist. And I think this is one of the very good points which Richard Dawkins makes, is that an infant is not born one religion or another. They're acculturated to that religion. They're conditioned to that religion over time. They're actually born as a human being, not as a Buddhist. So as that infant grows, they gradually learn language. And so this is, I guess, the first concrete or obvious step in the path towards developing a set of views is the acquisition of language. And of course we know that initially an infant's acquisition of language is very concrete, very simple, and is very immediate. It refers to things in the infant's immediate environment which are of concern to that child, to that infant. Things that matter. gradually the infant learns more and more names for things, more and more ways of putting those words together, sentences, grammar and so on, until they're able to formulate ideas and so on in an articulate manner. And that's one of the everyday miracles of humanity, is that children learn language, learn to be able to exchange ideas and talk about them. And that this happens everywhere in every culture to almost every person without anybody actually thinking about it, without you actually having to try to do it. It just happens. So at this stage, the child's worldview is conditioned, still conditioned by very concrete things, very immediate things. But language is opening up a possibility to speak about things that are more abstract and further away. Yeah, so this is one of the basic functions of language. Yeah? So rather than pointing to mummy and saying mummy, when you learn language, language enables you to say mummy left the home this morning. So you can get an abstraction in time and space, a sense of distance in time and space. And so this is kind of moving towards that more abstract level of views. Now, as the child is learning language, they are unavoidably being influenced and conditioned by the views and ideologies and opinions and beliefs of all those around them. This obviously happens everywhere. They're brought up in a Buddhist household, then they will from a very early age see a Buddha image, they'll hear people talking, they're using the word Buddha in a very reverential tone, they'll pick up a kind of emotional response to it and so on, they'll hear the stories, they'll be read Jataka stories and so on when they're very young, and they'll be conditioned in these kinds of ideas from a very early age. So even as their language is forming, and remember that language forms through these interactions with others, through interaction with story, the bedtime stories that children are read. They're discussing and talking with others. Language is being formed in a social environment, and that social environment is conditioning how that child's mind is working. It's creating categories, distinctions, creating ways of thinking, acceptable kinds of ideas, thinkable thoughts, and by inference, unthinkable thoughts. So all of these things are being emerging gradually and slowly until as a child matures, they begin to formulate more explicitly opinions about things, and learn at an even later stage of development to be able to reflect on those opinions, to be able to reflect on their own beliefs and so on. And I think the ability to do that is typically one of the products of adolescence, yeah, between the ages of probably 13 on up for most people. And it's one of the decisive things that enables children to become independent of their parents, so that rather than picking up their views and beliefs and so on primarily from just reflecting what's around them, they learn to reflect internally on their own beliefs and to challenge them and to make up their own minds about them. So in this way, beliefs emerge, and they emerge in that social context. And I think it's important to remember this from a very fundamental level, from even the level of the actual formation of language in the infant, that we are being conditioned by the nature of that language to certain views and away from certain other views. But of course, being conditioned by something doesn't mean that you're trapped by it. And this is where that stage of maturity happens, where you're no longer just mindlessly accepting that. So you're no longer, for example, you know, when I was a young child and my parents would go along to take us to Mass on a Sunday, and we would go because that's just what you did. and we were Catholics and we just did the Catholic things and so on and so forth, and that's just what happened. And it wasn't until maybe I was 14 or 15 or so that I started to reflect on this, started to question that, and started to consciously change my own views. And it was very conscious, I was very aware of that at the time. So when we are able to reflect on and change our views, then, as I said, this comes from that twofold process, both the inner and the outer process. So through the inner process of reflection is like thinking about it, asking, is this view consistent? Is this view, how do I reconcile certain views that I've learnt in the religion class at school and certain views that I've learnt in the physics class? And so you're going to go through this process. But it's also from external sources, both social conditioning through talking, reading and so on, and also through direct experience, whether something is, views are in agreement with what your actual lived experience is. And of course, one of the things which is very characteristic of that stage of development of adolescence and early adulthood is that we have very strong views about things. We're very idealistic, we haven't experienced very much, and we don't have a very kind of nuanced or subtle views of what's going on in the world, so we tend to sort of latch on to very simplistic ideologies and thinks that we've solved all of the problems of the world. And so this is why young people often tend to be very idealistic and so on. Which of course is not a bad thing, but it's just to recognise that it has its limitations as well. In my experience, for example, when I was growing up and became a university student and so on, my politics were, in theory at least, were anarchic. I believed that the best kind of society would be a society where people organized themselves and were more communal and consensus orientated rather than having force imposed on them from a governing authority. Now, I had this kind of belief and this kind of Marxist beliefs also about religion, that religion was exploitative and taught misleading doctrines to people in order to ensure the power of the hierarchy and the government and so on and so forth. So I had these kind of Marxo/anarchist views, although having said which, I wasn't necessarily convinced that that there was any point in trying to do anything much about those views. I didn't have the view that it was necessarily possible to create a better society by imposing these views on it. But it was more just something that I thought would be a better way of living, that's all. But it was interesting when I went to Thailand that many of these kinds of views and ideas became challenged. And of course what happened when I went to Thailand is partly a normal response that, well, you're simply out of your own culture, you're in somebody else's culture, so well, you should be respectful of that. And so there's a sense of being submissive and acquiescent to what people expect you to do and say and so on. So that was one side of it. But there was also another side, which was because because Thailand actually is a profoundly different kind of society. And even though it's highly westernized in many ways, but it's also of the countries that I've been to or that I know of, is one of the most insular and most sort of strong in its own culture rather than being affected by outside views. It's a peculiar mix. But certainly I found that being in Thailand, the way people talked, what they believed, how people thought, was profoundly different to my normal experience of what I had in Australia. And since I took that attitude of just respectful, trying to live there and trying to learn and understand, both before I became a monk and also after I became a monk, then I saw a lot of things which challenged the ideological notions that I had before. So, for example, while I had had the view that religion was a force that exploited the poor, my experience of living in Thailand was that actually the religion I saw mostly was one which empowered the poor, which actually supported good education, social development, environmental consciousness, and which was actually a very positive, supporting force in that culture. And so I came to see that my previous ideology, while not completely correct, was quite naive and needed to be nuanced and needed to be questioned, because my actual living experience was very different from what my ideology was. So this, I think, is pointing to one of the aspects of views which is very important, and that is that views have to remain to a certain degree open to and accepting of change, of experience, of what actually happens. That is to say, views shouldn't be too fixed. However, it's also important to avoid the other extreme, which is having views which are too flexible. And that having ideas which simply just ebb and flow and just go whichever way without actually giving the matter any consideration. And that's, I think, equally dangerous and equally deluded. And people who have very wishy-washy thinking and unable to think straight and to figure out what they actually believe and what's actually right and what's wrong, try to justify this by appealing to their kind of liberality and acceptance and so on. But it's not actually accepting, because that kind of view doesn't really accept the different kinds of views which happen in the world. It just doesn't understand them and can't be bothered to make the effort that's required to work out why do these people think like that, why do they have those ideas, why does this group of people actually say that they'd be different from the others. So instead we just sort of say, oh well, everyone's entitled to their own view, there are many paths up the one mountain, everything's all the same in the end. And so you can just sort of blurt out these meaningless platitudes that will somehow create a kind of socially acceptable ooze that will kind of allow these different views to kind of coexist in your mind without causing any problems. But it doesn't actually allow you to really understand what those views are. And so true acceptance, true understanding, means actually looking at them, actually listening to what they have, actually realizing why some views are different from other views, and actually looking at what the issues are. And being too accepting, overly accepting of different views, is a way of not listening. It's a way of actually bringing in another higher level view, and that higher level view is that some kind of untestable view, like everything's all the same in the end anyway. So we impose this higher level view, which is never subject to examination itself, and that precludes us from meaningfully considering what views may actually be. So this is that kind of extreme of looseness of view, and the other extreme, of course, is the rigidity of view. And in the extreme of rigidity of view, there's a dislocation where ideology is divorced from experience. And you know, this is what I think of when I'm thinking that of that, you know, time of myself and my youth and growing up. where you have these views which are divorced from the actual reality. Actually, in many ways, I still hold those same views. And, I still try to follow those same ideals. But I just do so in a much more nuanced way, a much less dogmatic way, because the experience of life has taught me that things aren't necessarily so simple. So this kind of rigidity of views, where there's a separation of the view from the experience, this is why in the modern discussion now, they talk about, with only a certain degree of irony, they talk about the reality-based community as being a kind of distinct body within society which is actually reality-based, which actually accepts evidence as being relevant, as opposed to the fundamentalists, which just simply dismiss evidence. There's a dislocation. And so that's that level of dislocation is inherently dysfunctional and harmful. It means that these important different aspects of the mind have stopped talking to each other. So this is that excessive ideological commitment means that there's a cessation or a cutting off between different aspects of the mind. So views have this important role, and the important role they have, if we come back to what I said earlier about the nature of a view being a pattern of something that's consistent over time, then a view has the role of organizing thought, organizing behavior, organizing your motivations, your reasoning, your thinking, so that things become coherent. If you don't have views about things, then you never actually be motivated to get anything done. Your mind will be chaotic. There's no direction in things. So it's the views which give us that direction. But on the other hand, the views have to be open to change, and they can't be too dogmatic. If you think about it in terms of a simple example, it would be something like making a building. So when you do a building, you have to have a plan. When you have the plan, you have to have some kind of view or theory or idea about what the building should be. But then when you actually build it, things never work out exactly the way that they are on the plan. You try to stick to the plan as best you can, but inevitably, things will come up and things will be changed as you go along. And that's not a bad thing. It just means that the plan is imperfect, and that experience tells you to change things as you go along. And so, but of course, if you don't have any plan, then you fall to the other extreme, not being able to actually get anything done. So this idea of views is something which should be developed. Okay? Views are often thought of and taught in Buddhism to be something which are harmful. And if you're attached to views, then this is a kind of a bad thing. And that, I think, is one of the most harmful teachings which is found in modern Buddhism. And it's a teaching which I believe is fundamentally in denial, because, of course, ironically, as the Buddha himself pointed out, that the idea that there should be no views is itself a kind of view. And because it's a destructive view, and a view which is divorced from the reality of how the human mind actually works, then it's a view which is both useless and also highly misleading. As I said before, the notion of view is embedded in the very fact of language. It's embedded in the very way that we communicate with each other. It's embedded in the very notion of personality, of a certain consistency and coherence in who we are, how we behave, what we do. So views are something that help us to construct our lives in a coherent and meaningful way. They give us a context. They give us a direction. They give us a sense of meaning. So this is why the Buddha never said to just abandon all views. He would say to abandon wrong views and to develop right views. So in that sense, views are something which are bhavetabha, as the first factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. Samadhi is bhavetabha, to be developed, not something to be abandoned. Of course, you do have this ambiguity in the suttas, where in some cases it talks about abandoning all views, but that's just an idiom in the Pali, and in those kinds of idioms, what it means is wrong views or misleading views. And elsewhere, so as well as wrong views being abandoning of the wrong views that have the wrong content, it also talks about the abandoning of wrong views in the sense of having an over-attachment to the views. It's called the abhinivesa, or the insistence. Only ita satcha abhinivesa, only this is true, everything else is wrong. So this kind of over-insistence on one's view is something which also needs to be abandoned. So when we're developing our right view, the right view of the Noble Eightfold Path, then that is something which should mirror and should happen naturally in a way that reflects how your mind is actually constructed, how the mind actually works. Bearing in mind the few little remarks I said about development and the psychology of views, how we develop a right view should fit in with that reality. It's not just something which is imposed on people. So if you try to impose right view on somebody, it never works. You can't force somebody to have a certain belief. But beliefs have a certain... But what we have to do is to understand that the beliefs and the views have a certain function. That's something I probably didn't emphasize enough. I meant to emphasize more when I was talking about it. But beliefs have a function. They enable us to do things. If you have a belief in God, for example... Now, maybe that belief in God from a Buddhist point of view is going to be wrong view. But on the other hand, if you're living in a Christian community, having a belief in God is actually going to help you to get along with the other people in that community. So they have so there's this powerful motivation. We're motivated to keep views because they help us, or at least they seem to help us. So unless there's that inner need, that inner benefit that we perceive that we can have from views, then talking about them and arguing about them is really a bit of a waste of time. Remember how the views evolve, starting from language. So just the introduction of words. Yeah? So, for example, in a modern context, there's a debate in the Buddhist community about the role of karma in Buddhism. And that's a good debate. It's a debate that needs to happen. But that debate can only... We can agree and disagree with different people's interpretation of karma, but we all share that word, karma. So we all have that, the foundation of these different views. Even though our views might be very different about what karma actually is and what it means and how important it is and so on, but the foundation of all those views is something that's shared in common, and that's the word karma. So this is why we shouldn't be too pessimistic about this, even though sometimes it seems useless to discuss with people about different views and so on, because you know you just end up disagreeing and end up in the same position that you were before. The point is that there's a basis for discussion, and that basis for discussion actually helps you to moderate and nuance your views and helps you to understand other people better. You're not going to change someone if they're stuck in their view because the view is serving some purpose for them. there's an underlying need that that view actually performs. And until that underlying need is not there anymore, they're not going to change that view for the most part. So it's when that underlying need is kind of loosened, when somebody's come to a juncture in their life when their values have been questioned, either through some external pressure or through internal development or for whatever reason. Things have loosened up, things have started to be questioned, and then people can go out and actually have that receptive state of mind, that mind that wants to learn, that wants to know. So as soon as you're in that mind where you're just dismissive of others' views, cynical and negative towards others' views because you know better, then you're not going to learn anything. So the mind that wants to know, the mind that listens eagerly, the mind that takes seriously and carefully what others say and considers, is this right, is this wrong? Is this good or is this bad? And the mind which recognizes that it has its own limitations, that recognizes that we don't always know what's right and what's wrong. Sometimes we just don't know enough to be able to say, and that's okay too. So that mind to be able to put things in suspension, to just hold them and wait and see whether anything is going to clarify that in future. So if we have this attitude of mind, this questioning of mind, it's not a bland, meaningless acceptance of everything everyone says, and nor is it a kind of dogmatic attachment and inability to listen to different points of view, insistence that only your way is right, but that mind which is inquiring, which is wanting to know, wanting to learn, wanting to understand. And that's the mind which will tend towards right view. That's the mind which will tend to examining carefully one's own views and seeing, actually, why is this view there? Looking inside oneself, saying, why am I so attached to this? We all know what that's like. Somebody disagrees with us and we get very angry. We get very emotional about it. Why am I getting emotional about this view? There's some connection between the idea and between some need that I have inside myself. What is that need? Why do I need this view? What kind of structure in my personality is demanding this view or is being held up by this view? And then very often when we do that and we see where it is that we're coming from, why it is that we're so attached to this view, then usually we see that there's some short-sighted sense of self-interest, some narrow sense of self-identity that's bound up with this view. Yeah? So for example, if somebody questions the idea of rebirth, then we might get very upset by that. Oh no, the Buddha didn't teach that, and so on and so forth. Why are we getting upset by that? Well, I'm getting upset by that because I think of myself as a Buddhist, and because there's a certain narcissism there which says that Buddha was good, therefore if I'm a Buddhist, I'm a good person, and I'm better than you because I'm a Buddhist. And if you're coming along and saying that my Buddhist views are wrong, then in some way you're saying that I'm not as good a person as I thought I was. And so I'm being personally challenged. And so that's where that emotional response is coming from. And so we have to learn to recognize that and to realize that actually I'm not practicing Buddhism so that I can pretend to be better than anybody else. I'm not practicing Buddhism so that I can be ideal of what a perfect person is according to this Buddhist notion. I'm not practicing Buddhism so that other people will think, oh, isn't that a good Buddhist? You're practicing Buddhism in order to be able to let go of one's attachments, one's sense of self, one's defilements. So then we realize that this is a misapprehension, a mistaking of the of Buddhist ideas, that even though the ideas themselves might be right, but the way that we're using them is wrong, and that's why we get all emotional by it. And so this is one reason why it's actually important to debate these things, because it's not until we do debate them and encounter people who have different views than ourselves that we realise where those attachments are. And so this is one reason why I do debate these kinds of issues with people. And it's not just because I'm on some kind of ideological crusade to convince everybody that my beliefs are right and everybody else's are wrong, but it's because one of the reasons is because I learn in myself why I'm attached to certain things and why I'm not attached to certain things. And over the years as I've done this, I've observed that I'm more and more able to do these discussions without getting upset about them or emotionally attached to them and so on and so forth. You're able to actually have better conversations about things. So when we're developing right view, the foundations of that right view is simply the language, the ideas. When you're hanging around in a Buddhist community, reading Buddhist books, talking to people who have Buddhist ideas, you're picking up certain kinds of ways of thinking about things, simple values like harmlessness and so on, which of course are not intrinsically Buddhist, but just kind of good values to have. But as well as that, you're picking up notions which are more specifically Buddhist, like Four Noble Truths, Dependent Origination, and gradually starting to form some ideas of what these things are. Those ideas are clarified by reading, they're clarified by discussion, they're clarified by reflection. And the more that we go on in our path, the more that it becomes useful to be very clear about these things. And one thing that I often encourage people to do is to read the suttas. And if we want to try to understand what the Buddha said, there is no substitute. We have to read the suttas and know what the suttas are saying, because they are the best record we have of what the Buddha said. And also, I believe that a sympathetic and sympathetic and broad-minded is not quite right, but a sympathetic and let's just say broad understanding of the suttas is, I think, an astonishing thing. And I think that the views, the ideas, the teachings that we find in those suttas are better than those that I found anywhere else. And no matter how many times that we can try to criticize them or find fault with them, that yes, there are certain details that we might question, certain things that we might want to abandon, but the important things remain, and the sense of poise, the sense of balance, the sense of depth and meaning to what the Buddha was saying, I believe, is unparalleled. The word I was groping for earlier, just to explain what I was trying to think of, was the Buddha said that you'll never understand the Dhamma if you're listening to the Dhamma uparamba chittang randhagavesi, with a mind which is fault-finding and always seeking for flaws. So then you'll never really understand the Dhamma. So when we're listening to the Dhamma, and this is not just the Dhamma, but to anything really, we listen with a mind which is sympathetic. That means that we're trying to connect with where that person, that other person who's speaking, where they're coming from. So we're not having an aggressive relationship to them, but we're trying to understand them and trying to make some kind of connection so we know where they're coming from. But the idea, the broadness, breadth, is the idea that we should look at the suttas as a whole, or at least look at a range of things and try to get a spectrum of understanding of things, rather than focusing too much on specific statements in particular places, because of course specific statements are often easy to interpret in one way or another. But when we look at the breadth and the overall teaching that the Buddha taught in so many times and so many places, in so many contexts, this to me is where the real beauty of the suttas come from. It's not from a particular striking or charismatic phrase or saying in one place, but it comes from the emergence of the way that the Buddha dealt with things constantly over a long period of time. So I don't know if there's a word that captures that, but anyway, that was what I was trying to, the sense that I was trying to convey there. So reading the suttas, considering them, discussing them, is one of the most important ways to improve our right view. Being open, being genuinely open in our own views and our own encounters with people of different views is also very important. Not open in the wishy-washy way of saying, oh, we're all the same in the end, but open in the genuine sense of really listening to what another person is saying and really trying to understand what they're saying without feeling threatened by it, and being able to respect the differences just as respecting the similarities. I've talked at length this evening about the development of view in that theoretical sense, and the whole talk so far has revolved purely around that initial developing of right view through thought, reflection, and so on and so forth. So please don't get the wrong impression. I'm not trying to say that this is the whole of what right view consists of. Far from it. This is merely the initial stages of it. The deeper stages of right view, where right view ripens into ripe understanding and right wisdom, this happens through the practice of meditation. And as we meditate, gradually those things which previously were just ideas become things which are deeply realized within our consciousness. So a notion like impermanence, to take an obvious example, is something that we can think about. We can look at the world around us. We can realize, oh, these things are all changing. We can reflect back at our own life and see that our own life has changed. We can look at society, realize society is changing. And so we can accept that everything in the world is in fact impermanent. But when we come to meditate, that same truth is realized again and again and again on a deeper and deeper and deeper experiential level. And it's that experiential level of right view which ultimately leads to letting go. The talk's been long enough for this evening, so I'm not going to go into that process in too much detail for this evening, but just to also mention that final point, which is that in the context of views, as with everything in the Eightfold Path, the outcome is everything. Right view is essentially defined. One way of defining right view is that right view is the view which leads to enlightenment. So if we have right view, and then we put in the effort to develop all the other factors, the outcome of that is letting go. And so there's a transcendence. And the experience of that transcendence, of course, is not a view, just like any other experience is not a view. But you can have views about it, and you can have views about what nibbana is or what enlightenment is and so on and so forth. That's not so important at the end of the day for that practitioner, right, because they have the experience, so having a view about it isn't really all that interesting. But they have the taste of it, just like somebody might have a view about what the best way, what this particular brand of coffee tastes like and whether it's a good one or whether it's not. But if I'm just drinking it, those views are not particularly relevant. I'm just drinking the coffee. So the outcome of right view is liberation and is letting go, and that's the final test of it. So that the there's no notion in Buddhism that somehow we can have a perfect view, that you can somehow have a set of ideas which is going to perfectly and in every way encapsulate everything about how the world is. I mean, this is an idea which came to be more characteristic of the late Abhidhamma period, perhaps at least sometimes, but we certainly don't find it within early Buddhism. Within early Buddhism, the notion of right view is that our understanding is sufficient. It's sufficiently accurate as a guide and sufficiently reliable to lead to the outcome, which is liberation. So that doesn't mean that you have to have every detail exactly correct. It just needs to be good enough to get to that outcome of liberation. And so our development of right view, our practice, our study, our discussion, our listening to Dhamma talks, all of those things has the sole purpose of supporting that liberation, which is the ending of suffering and the transcendence of all forms of views. And this is the final goal of Buddhist practice. So this is my little talk for you this evening on views, and I offer this for your reflection, and I'd like to invite if there's any comments or questions.